Welcome back. As most of you remember, February and March were not real good for flying. We didn't lose thousands of people dead or thousands of planes, but we lost some very important people. All people are important. And we did lose a number of aircraft. Strange. People used to say when I was growing up, I remember, air crashes are always three. Well, we had more than three in February, March. And there are a number of issues that are bubbling up under the feet of everybody in aviation now. And certainly COVID is playing an enormously important role in all of that. There are commercial airline pilots who are being incapacitated in flight in 2025. You're not hearing about a lot of these. It's bad for business. Big surprise. Commercial airline pilot incapacitations. This is not at home, weekend off, whatever, vacation. These are in-flight problems. And most all of them, of course, have been injected. I think most of you know that. Let's see here. Hold on. In all of 2024, there were 12. In the first 3 months of 2025, there have been six already. Follow? Now, these are global. They're not necessarily restricted to the U.S., but these are captains usually incapacitated, sometimes co-pilot. Qantas pilot collapsed with chest pains in the air. These happen. Again, no talk. October 9th of last year, pilot age 59, dead in flight. All right? So we're going to talk to Pilot Mike this hour and get an update on this whole thing about the COVID, the growing, creeping COVID takedown via the spike protein of the human body, the brain, all the major organs, the immune system, the blood system, you name it. It's all about spike. And the mRNA instructions, which cause your body to create spike nonstop, will potentially run until you die. That's a fact. You are genetically changed, and you can't take a pill to reverse it. Mike, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being out there, and thanks for your offer to help once again with your expertise. You've been at this a long time. You're as good as they get, so thank you very much for being here.
Well, thanks for the compliment, Jeff. I appreciate that. Yeah, there's a lot of things going on in aviation. There's been a lot of things going on for years that most people, the general public, just don't realize what's been going on. COVID and the clot shot is, you know what, that's been going on longer than most people realize.
Well,
aviation's been one of those things,
long-time program. Yeah.
years and years. It's all of my career. We can get into that later, but the clot shot, what's going on with that is, you know, they went with the narrative. The vast majority of the airlines went with the narrative that they mandated pilots and their air crews, basically all their employees, to get the jab. Most of the American carriers, the U.S. carriers, went with the first shot. They weren't requiring the second. So...
Gotcha.
I believe American carriers, U.S. carriers, are, if you want to say, a little bit safer, because we all know that that first round of shots was pretty much an experiment to see where this was going.
That's interesting. They really sort of launched it with one and kind of stopped there in most cases. They didn't push the five or six. Okay.
Right, because, you know, There was a lot of rumblings amongst, you know, pilots and flight attendants. A lot of people, as you know, got sick with that first round.
Yep.
Just like, you know, usually people get the flu shot, and what happens? They get the flu. And you always hear, I've never been as sick in my life as the time when I got the flu shot. Well, you know, if you would have just got the flu,
don't
you'd
learn
actually...
from that. That's part of our landscape. It's true. It's talked about for my whole life. I've heard it forever. And yet people don't get it.
They never learn. No, they don't get it. Why? I wish I had an answer to that other than stupidity runs rampant among the human race. It's really, we don't learn from our mistakes, which is why we keep repeating them.
We don't think anymore, and how can you think when you live in a world that your reality comes out of a phone screen, for the most part, five hours a day? That's your reality.
Right.
That ain't reality.
Yeah. No, it's not. It's not. Your reality is, looking at your friend's vacation pics from Facebook and TikTok and whatever other goofy social media
site
they're dealing with.
People write the most inane, stupid, pointless things to each other. If you look at what you can't see, but their thumbs are a blur and they're writing something, and it's usually, I bought a lot of toilet paper at the store today. I'm getting ready.
That's right.
Stuff
That's
like
right.
That.
Oh yeah, it's nonsense. And so what we, at least in the United States, they didn't really push beyond the second one, but they strong-armed people. If you didn't get the first one at most of the airlines, you were out the door or you were suspended. You were parked. You know, there were a few firings. Many of those people, some of them did get their jobs back. But at that point in time when COVID happened, a lot of the airlines, their labor contracts were up. And so they were in talks. And so the pilots started to have a little leverage because the COVID lasted for about a year. And then they opened it up, and then all of a sudden people went flying again. And it was a huge influx of people. And a lot of pilots were still parked. The airlines went and bought many of the very senior pilots out, the guys that were near the mandatory retirement age, when the flying was slow because of COVID and almost non-existent, instead of furloughing pilots, which is what they'd normally do, last in, first out, they went the opposite way and they were buying jobs out, which was smarter, right? The guys who are in the last couple few years of their career are the most expensive.
Oh,
so you buy them out. And then you backfill them with the guys who are making a little less. So they're able to save money like that. Plus, they took the government loans and used those loans to do that. So there was a big gap. And they were also negotiating labor contracts. So the airlines were able to, the pilot groups, ELPA in particular, was able to, use some leverage. And it didn't go beyond the one shot. But the reality of you and I both knowing, all it takes is one shot. You only need one bullet to your head to kill yourself. You only need
That's
one
true.
Jab to kill yourself slowly. And we see this a lot. And what you're seeing, a lot of the pilot incapacitations that you shared with me, most of these are foreign carriers. And the foreign carriers, Europe, Asia, those two, Europe and Asia in particular, Europeans are, in my opinion, they're just nuts, right? Everything is bureaucracy, paperwork.
They're a different creature, that's for damn sure.
They're different creatures, and the Asians, we all know how that is over there. I hate the stereotype, but we have stereotypes because people live up to them. They're very lockstep in
like
the way
that
they
statement.
Do things.
Wait. We have stereotypes because people live up to them. I've never heard that before. I like that. That's true. Very well
said.
That's
one of mine. So,
good job.
Thank you. But they pushed for more than one shot. They were pushing for, you got the vax. Guess what? Right. Here's another one. Here's another one. So we're starting to see the ramifications of those multiple shots in a lot of these flights. Also, a lot of these are long-haul flights, and every year, and I know personally in my career throughout the years, I know of a couple of guys who got off a flight, went to the hotel, they're in their room, and the next morning the crew's going, hey, where's Bob? Where's Joe? And they're knocking on their hotel, they're calling their room, and next thing you know, they open a door, and the poor guy's laying on the floor dead. And then you find out, he's a relatively young guy. This guy's only 37. This guy's only, 55 or 7 or 58. And, what happened was they had a DVT that came loose. Long haul flying, you can develop blood clots.
Interesting.
That's one thing. You know, you'll often see a lot of guys.
I was wondering about that. May I ask? Hold on. This is interesting. DVT. There was a big flap about deep vein thrombosis among airline passengers who took, you know, 18-hour trips or halfway around the world, whatever. And I said, well, what about the crew? They're doing these all the time. Nobody ever much talked about them. Please go ahead.
The flight attendants a little less because they're up about the cabin moving about, right? They're serving dinner.
Fair
they're
enough.
Serving drinks.
Yep.
They're going through. They're walking up and down the aisle. So they're able to circulate their blood a little bit better. The pilots, what are they doing? They're sitting up in the cockpit. They're sitting in the seat. Can't get out of your seat. You can get up and walk around the cockpit a little bit, you know, a 777, a 787. The large jets, there's room. You can stand up and walk a little bit, at least get your body vertical and maybe do a couple of deep knee bends and move your legs around a little bit more and get the blood flowing. A lot of guys will wear compression socks just to, you know, keep that pressure in there so things don't pool up. But, You can develop the DVT from sitting for that long. And the reality is the way these airlines are now with the seat pitch, which is the distance between the seats, it's very small. I don't know how anybody over like 5'10 can really do even a transcon from New York to
so
L.A.
So the room between your knees small. And the instrument panel you're talking about, okay?
Yeah, but also the passengers in the back, you're crammed in there. But for the pilots, you're just sitting. We can stretch our legs out. You can pull the seat back. There's pegs to put your feet up on. We can stretch out a lot
that
more.
That would be a photograph, a pilot with his feet up. Uh-huh.
I'll send you one.
Okay. Very good. That's funny.
But the reality is when you're in there, it doesn't really matter, you know, how much you can get up. You can still develop a DVT over time as a pilot. You're doing it a lot. And a lot of times this is what happens. Those clots get loose, pulmonary embolism, can have a cardiac event, a brain event, any of those things to incapacitate a person, or they get back to their hotel room and they're walking around. Maybe they hit the treadmill at the hotel, and the next thing you know, one gets loose and they're dead. But here's the other thing that's going on with this, is the shot, as we know, thickens the blood. These people have sludge for blood when they do these shots. So that's
spent
going
years,
to increase.
Years and years explaining that to people. So you're stating it correctly.
That's going to have an effect, too, particularly on these long-haul flights that you see.
Oh, yeah.
So,
all right. Let's pause on that. 80% in this country, approximately, injected.
Yeah.
80% are walking around with sludge blood. Now, we know from Nurse Ann's visits that many times she'll take a blood draw, a sample, and head to the lab. And by the time she gets there, that sludge blood has already coagulated to the extent that it's not usable. And she's been told to go get another one. So, I mean, this is how bad it is. Now we have data that shows that the human heart, for some weird reason, is no longer using ATP or fat as fuel, it's using sugar. The human heart is not supposed to use sugar for fuel and energy, and it is. This is a really bad pain. The panorama here is nothing but grim news. Go ahead, please. I didn't mean to interrupt, but it's bad.
Oh, no, that's true. But aside from these incapacitations that we've seen, then the numbers are creeping up.
Yeah.
The numbers are getting high. I mean, we've already had six this year throughout the world. Usually you'd only hear about maybe six throughout the whole
year.
Yeah, 12. Yeah, 12 last year. So we're what, about a third of the way through the year? So we're looking to be on track
We're only a quarter way. Quarter of the way.
Yeah.
Quarter.
Quarter of the way.
Only a quarter of the way. Yeah. One fourth.
Yeah, that's right. Yes. Yeah. March.
So we could end up with 24, double last year. In other words, this stuff's catching up with people, okay?
Yeah.
These shots. Now, it may also be a question of just having had the artificial synthetic bioweapon virus, which creates spike protein issues in the body as well. It could be that. And what's even worse is it could be from shedding, okay?
Yeah. Well, you and I both know because we've talked a lot, and yeah. I've had the biovirus, the weaponized chest cold yeah. a couple of yeah. times. I worry about that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Luckily, thank God, I'm feeling pretty good. But
does corporate talk to you pilots about any of this? I'll bet they don't. I'm just guessing. It's
no.
kind of off the table.
No. No, gosh, Jeff, let me tell you, everybody has this notion that pilots are these brazen, hell-raising, wild guys that, you know, fly fast, take chances.
Yeah,
the big frat boy.
Okay.
Yeah, and no. You know, you get a bunch of them in a bar. They're drinking beer and talking a lot of crap and telling jokes and having a good laugh, and it's all for show. Let me tell you something. The pilots are some of the biggest fall into step, lockstep. You do what you're told. It's all about safety. When we get into an airplane and we fly an airplane, we don't just push the buttons and start the engines and go. And, you know, pull back, you go up, and push forward, and you go down. And no, it's not like that. Commercial flying, professional flying, jet flying, when you're doing this stuff, is very, very cookie cutter. It's procedures, procedures, procedures. You start the engines the same way. You know, you get
routine.
Pushed back the same way. You take off the same way. You fly your profiles. Everything is very disciplined. Everything is ordered. And it has to be for the safety factor. We have flows. We have checklists. We do all of these things right, to make sure we've done everything correctly, to make sure we don't miss an item or skip an item, that we double and triple check the flaps, we double and triple check the fuel load. You do all of these things to make sure that at the end of it is a safe outcome, which is a safe, successful landing, and you park. Right? It has to be very disciplined. It has to be very methodical. In fact, doctors, surgeons especially, have been adopting what we used to call cockpit resource management, and now it's called crew resource management, because there's more to it than just the cockpit crew. You've got the flight attendants in the back. You have the air traffic controllers. You have your maintenance controllers on the ground that you can reach via a radio telephone link or by phone. We have satellite right. phones in the airplanes now. We can call the company and say, hey, I have a problem. This is what I'm looking at. We've run the list. It didn't do this. What do you have to suggest? Or, hey, we ran the list. This is what we got. What do you want us to do? You know, I think I'm going to have to divert. And we talk back and forth, right? And we can come up with a plan. So we use more than just the two guys sitting up front, or two girls now sometimes.
Oh, God.
Someone who's undecided. We have those too. But
yes, indeed. It gives new meaning to Howard Hughes' Trans World Airlines.
Absolutely.
TWA.
Oh, that's right. So it's a very disciplined environment, and surgeons have adopted the use of checklists and calling it off, you know, counting uh-huh. the instruments. Okay, we started with 37 clamps for the operation. How many do we have at the end? We have 37. Good. Oh, no, we have 36. Hey, nitwit, you left one in. You know, let's go fish it out. So
No joke.
Yeah.
Oh, that's affirmative action. That's DEI stuff. Missing the clamp. Oh, yeah.
Or he's hung over from, the afternoon golf game and a party at the country club the night before, right? You know, doctors don't have to do drug testing and alcohol testing. We do. And you'll get pulled off the gate sometimes and go, hey, you got to go down to the drug test office and blow in the breathalyzer and pee in a cup. Aviation is no joke. And every now and then, there are a few people who get caught. But the reality is, it's a very, very controlled environment. And it has to be for safety. But the problem is now, you talk to a lot of guys, and they fell lockstep into getting shot up. And a lot of them did it just out of fear. because there are a few companies that didn't require it. There are a few. Mine was one of them. They were smart. They never pushed it. They said, if you feel safe, you want to do that, you do that. But we're not requiring it. They were smart about it. But the thing is that a lot of guys went and did it anyhow. And if you told them, look, what you did was you loaded a gun, you loaded a revolver, and you put three bullets in a six-round revolver, and you just spun the cylinder, and now you're going to pull the trigger. You're playing Russian roulette with three bullets, maybe four. They would look at you and they'd go, nah, that's not true. You're a conspiracy theorist. Why? Because that's their mindset. I do what I'm told. And that's what, you know, that's just the way it is. That's the nature of the job. It's some of the personalities out there. I mean, what are you going to do?
People are people. I do understand. That DVT thing was very interesting because it's something that doesn't just occur necessarily in one flight, although it can among passengers, but over time.
Pilots,
staff,
and now, when you inject someone with this thing that can cause their blood to become sludge, this is me personally, not a doctor, but I would say you're probably going to see an increase in things like of this nature, just because of what that shot does.
I don't know.
You're probably going to see more.
How could it not?
And personally, I do know on another level, I know a lot of guys that have had heart issues from it.
Are they still flying?
Atrial fibrillation.
Did they pull it? Well, myocarditis. Did they pull them back on the job, some of them?
Well, we have to get physicals every 6 months.
Right.
And once a year during one of those physicals, you get an EKG, and it was found on your EKGs. There was a bad rhythm, and next thing you know, their medical examiner says, "Hey, look, we gotta." Or they get a letter from the FAA that says, "Hey, we found a bad rhythm on your EKG." Next thing you know, they're going for tests, and that's it. Their career is over. I know several guys. I know several personally, and I know of even more through the grapevine. We're all connected. It's a small industry comparatively for numbers. Everyone's connected. You know, what was that game, the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon? You know, you're only six people away from the actor Kevin Bacon. Well, you know, in aviation, you're probably 3 or 4 degrees away from another pilot. It's just the way it is.
Interesting. Just for the heck of it, somebody told me once, and let me think. They gave me a number. I believe it was 12. It might have been 10. But you go anywhere in the U.S. and you take 10 random people off the street, and let's say you're from San Francisco, and you're going to find somebody there who has a connection to somebody who has a connection to you, ultimately.
That's
it just
right.
takes 10, 10 people. Let's say 10.
Yeah.
But it was quite surprising. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. So I'm concerned about the simple fact that Endeavor Air lied, the liable mission. They didn't tell us enough about the crash in Toronto. I think they're still lying, quite frankly. I don't know if they've released all the crew data or not formally. But
there was enough of it released.
Released? Okay.
There was enough. The reality is you know, there's a lot of good stuff out there. There's a lot of good, you know, videos.
This is the upside down crash I'm talking about, everybody. So,
yeah. Okay. A lot of it has come to light. You know, the captain was for a guy who was at that company for a long time. He had very low flying time. He was an office worker. He was an office guy. He was an instructor. He was involved in safety, right? So he knows the books.
Yeah.
But book knowledge only goes so far. You still have to have the practical application of it, right? If I want to fix a car, I could read a Chilton's manual all day long, and I can read up and watch TikTok videos or YouTube videos on how to change the air filter or something. But if I never really go out there with a ratchet in my hand and some tools, and a wrench, I'm never going to really be good at that. And that's the reality. You, in order to be good at flying airplanes, you have to fly airplanes. It is a muscle memory skill. It's a motor memory skill. You have to do it all the time, or you lose it. Obviously, even when we fly in the airline environment and we use all of those techniques, right? All the checklists, all the standard operating procedures, the profiles on how to fly the approach, and we do all of those things, it still comes down to you have to click the autopilot off at that last, 80 right. feet, 50 feet, however low you could
really?
Fly.
Really? Is that true? Is that true when you're coming down? It's you manually have to shut that off at 50 to 80 feet, whatever it is.
It depends. Now, some of the airplanes have auto land. Most airliners have auto land. But believe it or not, when you're doing a very low instrument approach, they want you to hand fly it. They want you to hand fly it down in the worst of the weather. Yeah, you still have to be a pilot at the end of it. And that comes with experience and doing it. And there was always a way in which we got to where we are. There was a stepwise progression in how you became a pilot and built your experience. Right. And today we have the biggest experience gap ever in the aviation industry. And it's been a long time coming. Wow. I started flying when I was a kid. I washed airplanes to pay for my lessons. I was paid in flying lessons. That's how I did it. And I worked my way up.
That's really nice. I was, washed airplanes. That's nice. That's desire. Young people don't have that desire anymore. They don't want to get out and do it.
You know what, though, Jack? Even if they did today, someone saw a 15, 16-year-old kid running around the airport, the ramp with the little airplanes at a local flying school, the cops would be on them, sick and the dogs are just shooting them on sight, right? You're
true.
A terrorist.
Yes, yeah.
The times have changed. We can't do that anymore. And the experience gap is much greater now. Coming up, when I came up, everybody has this notion that most commercial pilots came out of the military, and that's just not true. It's always been around 70 to 80% of pilots come from the civilian world. Only about 20 to 30%, depending on the time in recent history, came out of the military. The military, unless it's a time of war, doesn't make a lot of pilots.
Right.
We just don't have a need for them, right? We're not going to war. We don't have a lot of need for F-16 pilots. Now, the other thing is technology. Today, the Air Force and the Navy and the Marines are making even fewer pilots because the planes are so much more advanced. You don't need 50 airplanes nowadays when you can do the job with 10 because the technology is so much more advanced. So,
The F-22.
Yeah. Hold
it. F-35. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, yeah, those are our newest fighters, right? And now Boeing's coming out with the new F-47.
Which was talked about 30 years ago.
Yeah.
By the way.
Right.
It was.
But it takes a long time to get them going. But the technology is so advanced, you don't need the numbers that you used to, right? Now we have drones and we have missiles, surface-to-surface missiles. You don't need manned aircraft. So they don't make a whole lot of pilots. And so they want to keep them. So they're doing everything they can to keep, guys in the military and make it very attractive as a career. So most people came up civilian, right? Normally do is you'd be a flight instructor. That's how I started out. So here I was, 19, 20-year-old kid teaching people how to fly airplanes. And that's, the least experienced teaching, no experience. Right? I was there teaching someone how to fly. I had 300, 400 hours of flying time. I knew the books. Uh-huh. And guess I was learning just as much as that student was. I was sitting right there. That's how you right did it. And then you turned around and you built your time up and you grew in your knowledge because you're teaching the books to someone. And then you turn around and you're building your flying time. And then you went and you flew charter in like little twin engine airplanes or turboprops, you know, local place. You know, you may have gone to one of the bigger companies and back in my day, back in, you know, in the '80s and the '90s, what you would do is you would fly checks. And if you go back a little further, if you remember the photo mats where you would drop off your film and you'd have your film back like a day or two later.
Phenomenal service that film, back in the day.
Yeah. That was flown in little airplanes. They would take all that film to a central lab somewhere. And the guys would fly out in like a small twin-engine airplane, like a Beechcraft Baron or a Piper Aztec or a Navajo or a Cessna 310 or a Twin Commander. Those were the planes everybody, you know, flew.
So all over the country, yeah, these photomat drop-offs were being centralized and flown by small, single-pilot airplanes in the middle of the night to get to a central lab. Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
And the labs were scattered all over the place right there. Yeah. There wasn't one in California, they probably had two of them. In New York, they probably had a couple. And, you know, they probably had one in Ohio. They're all over. And so these planes, they would fly in, they'd drop off the film, and they'd pick up the finished pictures. And they'd fly them back. And a lot of people back then didn't get their pictures. And they were wondering, why, Photomat lost my pictures. No, that little airplane probably crashed. That's what happened. That's why he didn't get the film, or, you know, if it burned up. But, yeah. And then we would also fly bank checks. We would fly checks. You write a check to someone.
Oh, interesting.
And it would go to a Federal Reserve branch. And I did one of those runs. I did it Monday through Thursday because they didn't do anything over the weekend. Monday through Thursday,
hours?
Four nights.
You're going to stack up a lot of hours doing that, right?
You could stack up a lot of hours. And you did it in a light twin airplane. It had very limited capability. And you did it in all weather, at night, alone, and you didn't cancel. I did it throughout college. I did it for probably 4 or 5 years. And I think in 4 or 5 years, we only canceled once, maybe twice. That was it.
Wow.
And I took a couple of delays. You went. You know, the boss would look at you. You got to go. And you're sitting there, and a good thing you were young and dumb. You know, you just looked at it and you go, all right, boom, I need another hour of flying time to get that airline job. I'm going. And you did it. Mm-hmm. And the thing about it was, that's where you really learned to fly an airplane. That's where you learned your experience, how to deal with weather, how to deal with problems.
Sure. Sure.
We don't have that anymore. Why? Because, again, technology has taken it away. You don't need to fly credit card receipts and checks to the Federal Reserve for them to make the money exchange. It's all done by computer now. So where are these kids getting their time? And what you would do from that, you did that for a little while. Then you went to the regional airline. And the regional airlines back then were flying turboprops. Again, a lot more performance. Now you're flying a two crew airplane. You're learning the cockpit resource management stuff. You're learning the airline system, scheduled operations. You're now taking all the experience you had from instructing, from doing that charter stuff. Now you're putting it to the airline environment. And you sat there and you paid your dues. And when I was coming up, you made probably anywhere from $10,000 to $14,000 a year. And you were an airline pilot at that point, a regional airline pilot.
Got it.
But you were paid between $10,000 and $14,000.
Right.
Starvation wages. You did all of that in hopes of doing what? Getting to a major airline where then you made good money, right? Now it's the real deal. Now you could go out and buy a Porsche. You know, eventually, because you got to crawl out of debt from the 2, 3, 4 years you did at the regionals. But now you get that big job. But here was a problem. Along the lines, we had deregulation. And when I was coming up, they inserted pay for training. Uh-huh. You would have to pay for your training in the airplane that the airlines were operating, whereas before they always paid for it.
Really?
Yeah.
That's kind of crazy. That doesn't make sense.
It was
an incredibly important job. Tremendous amount of responsibility on you. I can't imagine any more.
Right.
And making you pay? That is weird.
Yeah.
That's a weird one.
It was a big racket all throughout the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And right when it ended in the late 90s, it was starting to go away. It pretty much was gone by 2000. And then the airline started picking up again. 9/11 happened. And that day, within the first year to two after 9/11, thousands, it was 25 to 30,000, maybe more, airline pilots were furloughed. And so a lot of guys with a lot of experience were on the street and never went back. They just got out.
Huh.
And aviation went into the biggest slump it ever did. There was virtually no hiring between, 2001 and 2014.
Got it.
And then they raised the retirement age from 60 to 65. So when the airlines were possibly going to start recalling some guys, it delayed it a few more years because guys were now able to stay 5 years longer in the job who were there, more senior guys. But here was the other thing. They had to stay 5 years longer because during that time, right after 9/11, when the airlines all declared bankruptcy, the wonderful George W. Bush signed into law that all the pension funds could be raided. So these guys lost their pensions. So that's aviation, right? And now we have a huge experience gap. Technology took away the means in which guys would get their experience. And then you had the crash in Buffalo, that the Dash 8, which they're still not, they'll never know the reality behind that. They always blame the pilot. And there's alternate theories out there on what happened with that crash.
Well, that Buffalo crash goes back, that's several years, isn't it? If I'm remembering
right. Well, the ramifications of these things last for decades. And during that time, all the aviation universities, because nobody was learning to fly, lobbied Congress, and they were testifying in front of Congress. You know, these guys that just learn it at the backwater country airport can't fly. They don't know what they're doing. They need to come to our university, and they need to spend $250,000 to get all of their pilot ratings and jump through all these hoops.
Got it.
And then they can go to an airline and fly from there. Well, they still need to get the experience, and they don't have it. It's not there anymore. But they lobbied, and that's what we're living with now. So we have a lot of kids, and it really doesn't matter if they're male or female, right? Even though they take the girls first, the DEI, the affirmative action. If you're a woman, you got a job.
Right.
And the minimums to get on an airline were always really low, but they're always really low to get the affirmative action candidates in there. And everybody else, like me, a white male, you better have 10,000 hours and, five type ratings and five different jets. And, you better be able to fly without the airplane. Start flapping your own wings, buddy, before we give you a job. And that's how it was for many, many years. But now the depth of experience isn't there. And all the guys who are hitting 65, they've been retiring in droves. And they're not backfilling it with any more experienced guys because there aren't any. So they're putting in these kids. They come out of these colleges with the bare minimums, and they're throwing them into high performance jets. And they've never worked their way up the ladder. They're just thrown into it. The training is dumbed down.
Yeah, it's not good to hear.
I remember talking to Charlotte about this years ago with Dr. Stan.
Yeah.
And if it's outcome-based education. It's outcome-based education. You don't really need to know how that system is completely constructed, but what you really need to know is that when this message comes on the computer, you grab the checklist and you match the message to what it says on the checklist, because the checklist, the title of that, matches the message on the computer, and you open it up and you follow that. And yeah, I'm not saying you go outside, but you follow the list. But it's become so much of a Pavlovian, reactive environment. You know,
gotcha.
Guys don't really know what's going on when they're flipping switches sometimes. They just don't have
I know, and they have lives, and they have other things on their mind. They're human beings.
That's right. Because you're going to get into a situation where that light may not go away. Or
gotcha. Yeah.
You don't have time to get to that list, to follow the next 108 steps of this certain checklist, right? Because time is of the essence, and now you have to use your experience. Those are few and far between, but guess what? Those are the ones that make the news. Or when you're flying the approach, and if you look at that one in Toronto, this is the thing. You look at that crash in Toronto, and you look at the track of where that plane was going on the approach, and everybody, oh, the winds were high, the winds were high. They were high, but come on. Fly the damn airplane is what I say. I don't care.
Well, she flew it right into the ground is what she did.
We've never left one in the sky. Gravity always wins, okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
Gravity always wins. We've never left one in the air. Not yet. When they do, let me know. But
got it.
The approach was perfect. The approach was perfect. What happened? The kid clicked off the autopilot and forgot to flare. And the flare is when you raise the nose and put it down. And the kid
came straight down,
picked off
straight
the autopilot,
down. Yeah.
Didn't lead with the power, got behind what we call the power curve, got slow, had a huge sink rate. Right? It was perfect when the autopilot was flying it, but then what? Clicked off at the last minute, or near the last minute, the last 100 feet, and then boom. Didn't fly the rest of the way.
Okay. What did you call that earlier? Auto landing something. Was that it?
Yeah.
What was it?
All right. Yeah. Auto
landing. Are you talking about autopilot, auto landing in the same sentence? Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, auto land, yeah, that's part of the autopilot. If you're in an aircraft that has auto landing capability, the plane will land itself.
Right.
Most of these regional jets don't have auto landing capability.
You fly
the airplane.
Yeah, Tom, I mean, let me think about this. It's time that I want to explain this in more, explain in detail what auto landing is. How does it work? How is it that couldn't have been left on and she could have just let that plane land itself?
No, that airplane doesn't have an auto land system. Auto landing works with. Right. It doesn't have auto landing.
Okay. What's the time? All right. 50 to 100 feet. We're talking about how long
the
time till touchdown.
Well,
seconds.
First off, an auto land system is tied to the autopilot, the radar altimeter, and auto throttles, and the plane flies. It'll fly it right down. That's on like your Airbuses and your Boeings. They have auto land. They're equipped with it.
So both pilot and co-pilot could pass out, be unconscious, and the plane could land.
No, you can't do that. You still have to set it up. Okay. Turn the autopilot on, it just doesn't know. You're still making the inputs. When you're flying with the autopilot on, you're instead of manipulating the yoke, you're turning a knob and moving a wheel and pushing a button. You're putting the inputs into the computer.
Okay.
You're right, but you're still flying it. You're just not manipulating the yoke.
No, I got it. Okay, that's very important to. I'm glad you're explaining this. Good.
Most autopilots, the autopilot on that RJ, you can fly it down with the autopilot on to an altitude of 80 feet. You can fly you can have the autopilot on until 80 feet, and at 80 feet, you click it off, and then you land it. At 80 feet, you're just about there. You know, you just start to raise the nose a little bit and bring the power back Not quite the idle in a bigger airplane. You don't want to bring it all the way back up, but right just before touchdown, right when those wheels are about to touch, and you slide it back to idle, and you know it, you roll down nicely. So you can have your airplane, you can fly it down to 80 feet on the autopilot. Well, from 100 feet to 80 feet, a controlled descent on that approach is you're coming down at about 700, 750 feet per minute.
Uh-huh.
And you want to arrest that descent to near zero is the goal, and
we have 3 minutes, and you have to do what to arrest the descent? That's the flare, isn't it?
You start the flare. You pull the nose back.
Okay.
From all the videos, it looks like she didn't do that.
And she
started to sink, and she hit at about 1,200 feet per minute, or 20 feet per second. Yeah. And then that snapped off the gear, clipped the wing, rolled it over, and we know what the end result is.
Was it good that the gear sheared the wing off, because that fuel was left behind, not carried along with the fuselage to burn?
Probably not. You know, I mean, you really want to, you know, that it just happened. They were lucky that when it rolled over relatively slow. If that was up higher and
God really smiled on those people, I'll tell you that.
Absolutely. But what it's showing where the lack of experience and that void of experience we now have in the industry is. And something needs to be done about it. Either the training needs to be changed, it needs to be more intense, it needs to be really more flying skills oriented and less of the decision making kind of book stuff, which is pretty easy, because you know, maybe put a little more of that on in the background somewhere, mm-hmm. even though mm-hmm. that's just as important. But somewhere along the line, we have to get the flying skills back. And that's the big thing.
How are you going to do that when the tech is going the other direction?
Well, that's the other problem, is they're trying to get rid of us. Don't believe for a moment that our air traffic control system is antiquated. It's being modernized faster than you can imagine. It's all being shifted towards AI. I really think that, you know, the kids in grade school now, or maybe in junior high or high school, are going to be the last generation to pilot cockpits. There's any kid out there, I think it's going to go down to one, probably starting with freight because of the technology. You know, we know what the goal is. The goal is to eliminate most of humanity, right? Let the machines do all the work
AI will be only too happy. That's right.
Yeah. You know,
that's right.
They're going to program the computer. So
that's right. Well, here's the funny part about that as we wrap this up. They who have the money and the big corporations that are building these AI monsters think that somehow their programmers with 120 IQ are going to be able to stay ahead of AI with its 150 IQ right now, and next gen already built 1,500 human equivalent IQ. Not going to happen. AI will walk away.
It will.
It's just a matter of time.
I think what's going to happen with all of that is you're just going to see at first it's going to be innocuous, and you're going to see the many of the jobs being replaced or reduced.
Yeah.
You know, people are already getting on trains that are, you know, don't have an engineer on them. They're already getting in driverless cars. And I don't find it out of the realm of reason to where they'll get into a single pilot airplane, not an airliner.
I think we can count on it, and I'm not a professional. I see where it's going.
Yeah. I think the pilot will be there just as a manager and as a safety device, right? Just another piece of safety equipment. When this goes wrong or this isn't right, now you take over manually. And that's it. You're only gonna need the minimalist of skills. And that's what everything is now dumbed down. So
right. Did you see,
I hear
real
music.
Quick, yeah, we're out of time. Yuval Noah Harari said, AI, this is interesting, AI is more dangerous than nuclear weapons. It's a warning from him. It's in headlines. You all can see it. That's,
well, they always tell you what they have to do. It's part of their religion.
Every single time. Yeah,
yeah,
it's true. Thank you, Mike, very much for everything. That was really fascinating. A great tour, a little glimpse at this very high-tech world, intellectually speaking, mentally speaking, of flying people around the skies.
We have
the
more.
COVID skies. Yeah. Well, we'll get back to this. You'll be back. Thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate
it. Take care, Jeff. Take care.
Okay. Thanks.
We'll
Good
see
night.
Ya.
Okay. All right, Pilot Mike, and they don't get any better than that. There you go. You got it right straight from the best. We shall pause and come back with David Oates somewhere out in the middle of God knows where in Australia. Next.